It was empty, but open. He hid the BMW away from the highway and registered under the name of Eddie Lomax of Danesboro, Kentucky. He paid cash for a single room with an ocean view. The Panama City Beach phone book listed 3 Waffle Huts on the strip. He lay across the motel bed and dialed the first number. No luck. He dialed the second number and again asked for Ava Ainsworth. "Just a minute," he was told. He hung up. It was 11 p.m. He had slept for 2 hours. The taxi took 20 minutes to arrive at the Holiday Inn, and the driver began by explaining that he had been home enjoying leftover turkey with his wife and kids and kinfolks when the dispatcher called, and how it was Christmas and he hoped to be with his family all day and not worry about work for one day of the year. Mitch threw a 20 over the seat and asked him to be quiet. "What's at the Waffle Hut, man?" the driver asked. "Just drive." "Waffles, right?" He laughed and mumbled to himself. He adjusted the radio volume and found his favorite soul station. He glanced in the mirror, looked out the windows, whistled a bit, then said, "What brings you down here on Christmas?" "Looking for someone."
"Who?"
"A woman."
"Ain't we all? Anyone in particular?"
"An old friend."
"She at the Waffle Hut?"
"I think so."
"You some kind of private eye or something?"
"No."
"Seems mighty suspicious to me."
"Why don't you just drive?" The Waffle Hut was a small, rectangular, box-like building with a dozen tables and a long counter facing the grill, where everything was cooked in the open. Large plate glass windows lined one side next to the tables, so the customers could take in the strip and the condos in the distance while they enjoyed their pecan waffles and bacon. The small parking lot was almost full, and Mitch directed the driver to an empty slot near the building.
"Ain't you getting out?" the driver asked.
"No. Keep the meter running."
"Man, this is strange." "You'll get paid." "You got that right."
Mitch leaned forward and rested his arms on the front seat. The meter clicked softly as he studied the customers inside. The driver shook his head, slumped in the seat, but watched out of curiosity. In the corner next to the cigarette machine, a table of fat tourists with long shirts, white legs, and black socks drank coffee and all talked at the same time while glancing at the menus. The leader, the one with an unbuttoned shirt, a heavy gold chain draped upon his chest hair, thick gray sideburns, and a Phillies baseball cap, looked repeatedly toward the grill in search of a waitress.
"You see her?" asked the driver.
Mitch said nothing, then leaned forward and frowned. She appeared from nowhere and stood at the table with her pen and order book. The leader said something funny, and the fat people laughed. She never smiled, just kept writing. She was frail and much thinner, almost too thin. The black and white uniform fit snugly and squeezed her tiny waist. Her gray hair was pulled tightly and hidden under the Waffle Hut bonnet. She was 51, and from the distance, she looked her age. Nothing worse. She seemed sharp. When she finished scribbling, she snatched the menus from their hands, said something polite, almost smiled, then disappeared. She moved quickly among the tables, pouring coffee, handing ketchup bottles, and giving orders to the cook. Mitch relaxed. The meter ticked slowly.
"Is that her?"
asked the driver. "Yes."
"What now?"
"I don't know."
"Well, we found her, didn't we?"
Mitch followed her movements and said nothing. She poured coffee for a man sitting alone. He said something, and she smiled. A wonderful, gracious smile. A smile he had seen 1,000 times in the darkness, staring at the ceiling. his mother's smile. A light mist began to fall, and the intermittent wipers cleaned the windshield every 10 seconds. It was almost midnight, Christmas Day. The driver tapped the wheel nervously and fidgeted. He sank lower in the seat, then changed stations. "How long we gonna sit here?" "Not long." "Man, this is weird." "You'll be paid." "Man, money ain't everything. It's Christmas. I got kids at home, kinfolks visiting, turkey and wine to finish off, and here I am sitting at the Waffle Hut so you can look at some old woman through the window." "It's my mother."
"Your what?"
"You heard me."
"Man, oh man, I get all kinds."
"Just shut up, okay?"
"Okay. Ain't you gonna talk to her? I mean, it's Christmas, and you found your mama. You gotta go see her, don't you?"
"No. Not now." Mitch sat back in the seat and looked at the dark beach across the highway. "Let's go." At daybreak, he dressed in jeans and a sweatshirt, no socks or shoes, and took Hearsay for a walk on the beach. They walked east toward the first glow of orange peeking above the horizon. The waves broke gently 30 yards out and rolled quietly onto shore. The sand was cool and wet. The sky was clear and full of seagulls talking incessantly among themselves. Hearsay ran boldly into the sea, then retreated furiously when the next wave of white foam approached. For a house dog, the endless stretch of sand and water demanded exploration. He ran 100 yards ahead of Mitch. After 2 miles, they approached a pier, a large concrete structure running 200 feet from the beach into the ocean. Hearsay, fearless now, darted onto it and ran to a bucket of bait next to 2 men standing motionless and staring down at the water. Mitch walked behind them to the end of the pier, where a dozen fishermen talked occasionally to each other and waited for their lines to jump. The dog rubbed himself on Mitch's leg and grew still. A brilliant return of the sun was in progress, and for miles the water glistened and turned from black to green. Mitch leaned on the railing and shivered in the cool wind. His bare feet were frozen and gritty. For miles along the beach in both directions, the hotels and condos sat quietly and waited for the day. There was no one on the beach. Another pier jutted into the water miles away. The fishermen spoke with the sharp, precise words of those from the north. Mitch listened long enough to learn the fish were not biting. He studied the sea. Looking southeast, he thought of the Caymans and A-Banks. And the girl, for a moment, then she was gone. He would return to the islands in March for a vacation with his wife. Damn the girl. Surely he would not see her. He would dive with A-Banks and cultivate a friendship. They would drink Heineken and Red Stripe at his bar and talk of Hodge and Kaczynski. He would follow whoever was following him. Now that Abby was an accomplice, she would assist him. The man waited in the dark beside the Lincoln Town Car. He nervously checked his watch and glanced at the dimly lit sidewalk that disappeared in front of the building. On the second floor, a light was turned off. A minute later, the private eye walked from the building toward the car. The man walked up to him. "Are you Eddie Lomax?" he asked anxiously. Lomax slowed, then stopped. They were face to face.
"Yeah. Who are you?"
The man kept his hands in his pockets. It was cold and damp, and he was shaking. "Al Kilbury. I need some help, Mr. Lomax. Real bad. I'll pay you right now in cash. Whatever you want. Just help me."
"It's late, pal."
"Please. I've got the money. Name the price. You gotta help, Mr. Lomax." He pulled a roll of cash from his left pants pocket and stood, ready to count.
Lomax looked at the money, then glanced over his shoulder.
What's the problem?
My wife.
In an hour, she's supposed to meet a man at a motel in South Memphis. I've got the room number and all. I just need you to go with me and take pictures of them coming and going.
How do you know this?
Phone taps. She works with the man, and I've been suspicious. I'm a wealthy man, Mr. Lomax, and it's imperative I win the divorce. I'll pay you $1,000 in cash now. He quickly peeled off 10 bills and offered them. Lomax took the money.
Okay, let me get my camera.
Please hurry. Everything's in cash, okay? No records.
Suits me, said Lomax as he walked toward the building.
20 minutes later, the Lincoln rolled slowly through the crowded parking lot of a Days Inn. Kilbury pointed to a second-floor room on the back side of the motel, then to a parking space next to a brown Chevy van. Lomax backed carefully alongside the van and parked his town car. Kilbury again pointed to the room, again checked his watch, and again told Lomax how much he appreciated his services. Lomax thought of the money. $1,000 for 2 hours' work. Not bad. He unpacked a camera, loaded the film, and gauged the light. Kilbury watched nervously, his eyes darting from the camera to the room across the parking lot. He looked hurt. He talked of his wife and their wonderful years together and why, oh, why was she doing this? Lomax listened and watched the rows of parked cars in front of him. He held his camera. He did not notice the door of the brown van. It quietly and slowly slid open, just 3 feet behind him. A man in a black turtleneck wearing black gloves crouched low in the van and waited. When the parking lot was still, he jumped from the van, yanked open the left rear door of the Lincoln, and fired 3 times into the back of Eddie's head. The shots, muffled with a silencer, could not be heard outside the car. Eddie slumped against the wheel, already dead. Kilbury bolted from the Lincoln, ran to the van, and sped away with the assassin.
Chapter 18. After 3 days of unbillable time, of no production, of exile from their sanctuaries, of turkey and ham and cranberry sauce and new toys that came unassembled, the rested and rejuvenated lawyers of Bendini, Lambert, and Locke returned to the fortress on Front Street with a vengeance. The parking lot was full by 7:30. They sat fixed and comfortable behind their heavy desks, drank coffee by the gallons, meditated over mail and correspondence and documents, and mumbled incoherently and furiously into their dictaphones. They barked orders at secretaries and clerks and paralegals and at each other. There were a few "How was your Christmas?" greetings in the halls and around the coffee pots, but small talk was cheap and unbillable. The sounds of typewriters, intercoms, and secretaries all harmonized into one glorious hum as the Mint recovered from the nuisance of Christmas. Oliver Lambert walked the halls, smiling with satisfaction and listening, just listening to the sounds of wealth being made by the hour. At noon, Lamar walked into the office and leaned across the desk. Mitch was deep into an oil and gas deal in Indonesia.
Lunch? Lamar asked.
No, thanks. I'm behind.
Aren't we all? I thought we could run down to the Front Street Deli for a bowl of chili.
I'll pass. Thanks. Lamar glanced over his shoulder at the door and leaned closer as if he had extraordinary news to share.
You know what today is, don't you?
Mitch glanced at his watch.
The 28th. Right. And do you know what happens on the 28th of December of every year?
You have a bowel movement.
Yes.
And what else?
Okay, I give up. What happens?
At this very moment, in the dining room on the fifth floor, all the partners are gathered for a lunch of roast duck and French wine.
Wine for lunch?
Yes, it's a very special occasion.
Okay.
After they eat for an hour, Roosevelt and Jesse Francis will leave and Lambert will lock the door. Then it's all the partners, you see. Only the partners. And Lambert will hand out a financial summary for the year. It's got all the partners listed, and beside each name is a number that represents their total billing for the year. Then on the next page is a summary of the net profits after expenses. Then, based on production, they divide the pie.
Mitch hung on every word.
And?
And, last year the average piece of pie was $330,000.
And, of course, it's expected to be even higher this year. Goes up every year.
$330,000, Mitch repeated slowly.
Yep. And that's just the average. Locke will get close to $1,000,000. Victor Milligan will run a close second.
And what about us?
We get a piece, too. A very small piece. Last year it was around $9,000 on the average. Depends on how long you've been here and production.
Can we go watch?
They wouldn't sell a ticket to the president. It's supposed to be a secret meeting, but we all know about it. Word will begin drifting down late this afternoon.
When do they vote on who to make the next partner?
Normally it would be done today. But according to rumor, there may not be a new partner this year because of Marty and Joe.
I think Marty was next in line, then Joe.
Now they might wait a year or two.
So who's next in line?
Lamar stood straight and smiled proudly.
1 year from today, my friend, I will become a partner in Bendini, Lambert, and Locke.
I'm next in line, so don't get in my way this year.
I heard it was Massengill. A Harvard man, I might add.
Massengill doesn't have a prayer. I intend to bill 140 hours a week for the next 52 weeks, and those birds will beg me to become a partner. I'll go to the fourth floor, and Massengill will go to the basement with the paralegals.
I'm putting my money on Massengill.
He's a wimp. I'll run him into the ground.
Let's go eat a bowl of chili, and I'll reveal my strategy.
Thanks, but I need to work.
Lamar strutted from the office and passed Nina, who was carrying a stack of papers. She laid them on a cluttered corner of the desk.
I'm going to lunch. Need anything?
No, thanks.
Yes, a Diet Coke.
The halls quietened during lunch as the secretaries escaped the building and walked toward downtown to a dozen small cafes and delicatessens nearby. With half the lawyers on the fifth floor counting their money, the gentle roar of commerce took an intermission. Mitch found an apple on Nina's desk and rubbed it clean. He opened a manual on IRS regulations, laid it on the copier behind her desk, and touched the green print button. A red warning lit up and flashed the message, "Insert file number." He backed away and looked at the copier.
Yes, it was a new one.
Next to the print button was another that read, "Bypass." He stuck his thumb on it. A shrill siren erupted from within the machine, and the entire panel of buttons turned bright red. He looked around helplessly, saw no one, and frantically grabbed the instruction manual. "What's going on here?" someone demanded over the wailing of the copier. "I don't know," Mitch yelled, waving the manual. Leela Pointer, a secretary too old to walk from the building for lunch, reached behind the machine and flipped a switch. The siren died. "What the hell?" Mitch said, panting. "Didn't they tell you?" she demanded, grabbing the manual and placing it back in its place. She drilled a hole in him with her tiny, fierce eyes, as if she had caught him in her purse. "Obviously not. What's the deal?" "We have a new copying system," she lectured downward through her nose. "It was installed the day after Christmas. You must code in the file number before the machine will copy. Your secretary was supposed to tell you."
"You mean this thing will not copy unless I punch in a 10-digit number?"
"That's correct."
"What about copies in general, with no particular file?"
"Can't be done. Mr. Lambert says we lose too much money on unbilled copies. So from now on, every copy is automatically billed to a file. You punch in the number first. The machine records the number of copies and sends it to the main terminal, where it goes on the client's billing account."
"What about personal copies?"
Leela shook her head in total frustration.
"I can't believe your secretary didn't tell you all this."
"Well, she didn't, so why don't you help me out?" "You have a 4-digit access number for yourself. At the end of each month, you'll be billed for your personal copies." Mitch stared at the machine and shook his head. "Why the damned alarm system?"
"Mr. Lambert says that after 30 days, they will cut off the alarms. Right now, they're needed for people like you. He's very serious about this. Says we've been losing thousands on unbilled copies."
"Right. And I suppose every copier in the building has been replaced."
She smiled with satisfaction.
"Yes, all 17. "Thanks." Mitch returned to his office in search of a file number.
At 3 that afternoon, the celebration on the 5th floor came to a joyous conclusion, and the partners, now much wealthier and slightly drunker, filed out of the dining room and descended to their offices below. Avery, Oliver Lambert, and Nathan Locke walked the short hallway to the security wall and pushed the button. Devasher was waiting. He waved at the chairs in his office and told them to sit down. Lambert passed around hand-wrapped Hondurans, and everyone lit up.
"Well, I see we're all in a festive mood," Devasher said with a sneer. "How much was it? 390,000, average?"
"That's correct, Devasher," Lambert said. "It was a very good year."
He puffed slowly and blew smoke rings at the ceiling.
"Did we all have a wonderful Christmas?" Devasher asked.
"What's on your mind?" Locke demanded.
"Merry Christmas to you too, Nat."
"Just a few things.
I met with Lazarov 2 days ago in New Orleans. He does not celebrate the birth of Christ, you know. I brought him up to date on the situation down here, with emphasis on McDear and the FBI. I assured him there had been no further contact since the initial meeting. He did not quite believe this and said he would check with his sources within the Bureau. I don't know what that means, but who am I to ask questions? He instructed me to trail McDear 24 hours a day for the next 6 months. I told him we were already doing so, sort of. He does not want another Hodge Kaczynski situation. He's very distressed about that. McDear is not to leave the city on firm business unless at least 2 of us go with him.
He's going to Washington in 2 weeks, Avery said.
What for?
American Tax Institute. It's a 4-day seminar that we require of all new associates. It's been promised to him, and he'll be very suspicious if it's canceled.
We made his reservations in September, Ollie added.
I'll see if I can clear it with Lazarov, Devasher said. Give me the dates, flights, and hotel reservations. He won't like this.
What happened Christmas? Locke asked.
Not much. His wife went to her home in Kentucky. She's still there. McDear took the dog and drove to Panama City Beach, Florida. We think he went to see his mom, but we're not sure. Spent one night at a Holiday Inn on the beach. Just he and the dog. Pretty boring. Then he drove to Birmingham, stayed in another Holiday Inn, then early yesterday morning he drove to Brushy Mountain to visit his brother. Harmless trip.
What's he said to his wife? Asked Avery.
Nothing as far as we can tell. It's hard to hear everything.
Who else are you watching? Asked Avery.
We're listening to all of them, sort of sporadically. We have no real suspects other than McDear, and that's just because of Terrence. Right now, all's quiet.
He's got to go to Washington, Devasher, Avery insisted.
Okay, okay. I'll get it cleared with Lazarov. He'll make us send 5 men for surveillance.
What an idiot.
Ernie's airport lounge was indeed near the airport. Mitch found it after 3 attempts and parked between 2 four-wheel drive swamp mobiles with real mud caked on the tires and headlights. The parking lot was full of such vehicles. He looked around and instinctively removed his tie. It was almost 11. The lounge was deep and long and dark, with colorful beer signs flashing in the painted windows. He looked at the note again, just to be sure. Dear Mr. McDear, please meet me at Ernie's Lounge on Winchester tonight. Late. It's about Eddie Lomax. Very important. Tammy Hemphill, his secretary. The note had been tacked on the door to the kitchen when he arrived home. He remembered her from the one visit to Eddie's office back in November. He remembered the tight leather skirt, huge breasts, bleached hair, red sticky lips, and smoke billowing from her nose. And he remembered the story about her husband, Elvis. The door opened without incident, and he slid inside. A row of pool tables covered the left half of the room. Through the darkness and black smoke, he could make out a small dance floor in the rear. To the right was a long, saloon-type bar crowded with cowboys and cowgirls, all drinking Bud Longnecks. No one seemed to notice him. He walked quickly to the end of the bar and slid onto the stool. "Bud Longneck," he told the bartender. Tammy arrived before the beer. She was sitting and waiting on a crowded bench by the pool tables. She wore tight washed jeans, faded denim shirt, and kinky red high heels. The hair had just received a fresh bleaching.
"Thanks for coming," she said into his face. "I've been waiting for 4 hours. I knew of no other way to find you."
Mitch nodded and smiled as if to say, "It's okay, you did the right thing."
"What's up?" he said.
She looked around.
"We need to talk, but not here."
"Where do you suggest?"
"Could we maybe drive around?"
"Sure, but not in my car. It may not be a good idea."
"I've got a car. It's old, but it'll do."
Mitch paid for the beer and followed her to the door. A cowpoke sitting near the door said, "Get a load of this. Guy shows up with a suit and picks her up in 30 seconds. Mitch smiled at him and hurried out the door. Dwarfed in a row of massive mud-eating machinery was a well-worn Volkswagen Rabbit. She unlocked it and Mitch doubled over and squeezed into the cluttered seat. She pumped the accelerator 5 times and turned the key. Mitch held his breath until it started.
"Where would you like to go?" she asked.
"Where we can't be seen," Mitch thought. "You're driving."
You're married, aren't you?
She asked.
Yes. You?
Yes, and my husband would not understand this situation right here. That's why I chose that dump back there. We never go there.
She said this as if she and her husband were discriminating critics of dark redneck dimes.
I don't think my wife would understand either. She's out of town, though.
Tammy drove in the direction of the airport.
I've got an idea, she said. She clutched the steering wheel tightly and spoke nervously.
What's on your mind? Mitch asked.
Well, you heard about Eddie.
Yes.
When did you last see him?
We met 10 days or so before Christmas. It was sort of a secret meeting.
That's what I thought. He kept no records of the work he was doing for you. Said you wanted it that way. He didn't tell me much. But me and Eddie, well, we were close.
Mitch could think of no response.
I mean, we were very close. Know what I mean?
Mitch grunted and sipped the long neck.
And he told me things I guess he wasn't supposed to tell me. Said you had a real strange case. That some lawyers in your firm had died under suspicious circumstances. And that you always thought somebody was following and listening. That's pretty weird for a law firm.
So much for the confidentiality, thought Mitch.
That it is.
She turned, made the exit to the airport, and headed for the acres of parked cars.
And after he finished his work for you, he told me once, just once, in bed, that he thought he was being followed. This was 3 days before Christmas. And I asked him who it was. He said he didn't know, but mentioned your case, and something about it was probably related to the same people who were following you. He didn't say much.
She parked in the short-term section near the terminal.
Who else would follow him? Mitch asked.
No one.
He was a good investigator who left no trail. I mean, he was an ex-cop and an ex-con. He was very street smart. He got paid to follow people and collect dirt. No one followed him. Never.
So who killed him?
Whoever was following him. The paper made like he got caught snooping on some rich guy and was wasted. It's not true.
Suddenly, from out of nowhere, she produced a filter tip 1000 and shot a flame at the end. Mitch rolled down the window.
Mind if I smoke? She asked.
No, just blow it that way, he said, pointing to her window.
Anyway, I'm scared. Eddie was convinced the people following you are extremely dangerous and extremely smart. Very sophisticated was what he said. And if they killed him, what about me? Maybe they think I know something. I haven't been to the office since the day he was killed. Don't plan to go back.
I wouldn't if I were you.
I'm not stupid. I worked for him for 2 years and learned a lot. There's a lot of nuts out there. We saw all kinds.
How did they shoot him?
He's got a friend in homicide. Guy told me confidentially that Eddie got hit 3 times in the back of the head, point-blank range with a .22 pistol. And they don't have a clue. He told me it was a very clean, professional job.
Mitch finished the long neck and laid the bottle on the floorboard with a half dozen empty beer cans. A very clean, professional job.
It doesn't make sense, she repeated. I mean, how could anyone sneak up behind Eddie, somehow get in the back seat and shoot him 3 times in the back of the head? And he wasn't even supposed to be there.
Maybe he fell asleep and they ambushed him.
Now,
He took all kinds of speed when he was working late at night. Stayed wired.
Are there any records at the office?
You mean about you?
Yeah, about me.
I doubt it. I never saw nothing in writing. He said you wanted it that way.
That's right, Mitch said with relief. They watched a 727 lift off to the north. The parking lot vibrated.
I'm really scared, Mitch. Can I call you Mitch?
Sure, why not?
I think he got killed because of the work he did for you. That's all it could be. And if they'd kill him because he knew something, they probably assume I know it too. What do you think?
I wouldn't take any chances.
I might disappear for a while. My husband does a little nightclub work, and we can get mobile if we have to. I haven't told him all this, but I guess I have to. What do you think?
Where would you go?
Little Rock, St. Louis, Nashville. He's laid off, so we can move around, I guess.
Her words trailed off.
She lit another one.
A very clean, professional job, Mitch repeated to himself. He glanced at her and noticed a small tear on her cheek. She was not ugly, but the years in lounges and nightclubs were taking their toll. Her features were strong, and minus the bleach and heavy makeup, she would be somewhat attractive for her age. About 40, he guessed. She took a mighty drag and sent a cloud of smoke surging from the rabbit.
I guess we're in the same boat, aren't we? I mean, they're after both of us. They've killed all those lawyers. Now Eddie. And I guess we're next.
Don't hold back, baby. Just blurt it out.
Look, let's do this. We need to keep in touch. You can't call me on the phone, and we can't be seen together. My wife knows everything, and I'll tell her about this little meeting. Don't worry about her. Once a week, write me a note and tell me where you are.
What's your mother's name?
Doris.
Good. That's your code name. Sign the name Doris on anything you send me.
Do they read your mail, too?
Probably so, Doris. Probably so.
Chapter 19. At 5 p.m., Mitch turned off the light in his office, grabbed both briefcases, and stopped at Nina's desk. Her phone was glued to one shoulder while she typed on the IBM. She saw him and reached in a drawer for an envelope.
"This is your confirmation at the Capitol Hilton," she said into the receiver.
"The dictation is on my desk," he said. "See you Monday." He took the stairs to the fourth floor, to Avery's office in the corner, where a small riot was in progress. One secretary stuffed files into a massive briefcase. Another one spoke sharply to Avery, who was yelling on the phone to someone else. A paralegal shot orders to the first secretary. Avery slammed the phone down.
"Are you ready?" he demanded at Mitch.
"Waiting for you," Mitch replied.
"I can't find the green mark file," a secretary snarled at the paralegal.
"It was with the Racone file," said the paralegal.
"I don't need the green mark file," Avery shouted. "How many times do I have to tell you? Are you deaf?"
The secretary glared at Avery.
"No, I can hear very well, and I distinctly heard you say, pack the green mark file."
"The limousine is waiting," said the other secretary.
"I don't need the damned green mark file," Avery shouted.
"How about Racone?" asked the paralegal.
"Yes, yes, for the 10th time, I need the Racone file."
"The airplane is waiting too," said the other secretary. One briefcase was slammed shut and locked. Avery dug through a pile of documents on his desk.
"Where's the Fender file?"
"Where are any of my files? Why can't I ever find a file?" Here's Fender, said the first secretary as she stuffed it into another briefcase. Avery stared at a piece of notepaper. All right. Do I have Fender, Racconi, Cambridge Partners, Green Group, Sunny Caps to Otaki, Burton Brothers, Galveston Freight, and McQuaid? Yes, 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 said the first secretary. That's all of them, said the paralegal. I don't believe it, Avery said as he grabbed his jacket. Let's go. He strode through the door with the secretaries, paralegal, and Mitch in pursuit. Mitch carried two briefcases. The paralegal had two, and the secretary had one. The other secretary scribbled notes as Avery barked the orders and demands he wanted carried out while he was away. The entourage crowded onto the small elevator for the ride to the first floor. Outside, the chauffeur sprang into action, opening doors and loading it all in the trunk. Mitch and Avery fell into the back seat. Relax, Avery, Mitch said. You're going to the Caymans for 3 days. Just relax. Right, right. I'm taking with me enough work for a month. I've got clients screaming for my hide, threatening suits for legal malpractice. I'm 2 months behind, and now you're leaving for 4 days of boredom at a tax seminar in Washington. Your timing is great, McDear. Just great. Avery opened a cabinet and mixed a drink. Mitch declined. The limo moved around Riverside Drive in the rush hour traffic. After 3 swallows of gin, the partner breathed deeply. Continuing education. What a joke, Avery said. You did it when you were a rookie. And if I'm not mistaken, you spent a week not long ago at that international tax seminar in Honolulu. Or did you forget? It was work. All work. Are you taking your files with you? Of course, Avery. I'm expected to attend the tax seminar 8 hours a day, learn the latest tax revisions Congress has bestowed upon us, and in my spare time, bill 5 hours a day. 6, if you can. We're behind, Mitch. We're always behind, Avery. Fix another drink. You need to unwind. I plan to unwind at Rumheads. Mitch thought of the bar with its red stripe, dominoes, darts, and, yes, string bikinis. And the girl. Is this your first flight on the Lear? Avery asked, more relaxed now. Yes. I've been here 7 months, and I'm just now seeing the plane. If I had known this last March, I'd have gone to work with a Wall Street firm. You're not Wall Street material. You know what those guys do? They've got 300 lawyers in a firm, right? And each year they hire 30 new associates, maybe more. Everybody wants a job because it's Wall Street, right? And after about a month, they get all 30 of them together in one big room and inform them they're expected to work 90 hours a week for 5 years. And at the end of 5 years, half of them will be gone. The turnover is incredible. They try to kill the rookies, bill them out at 100, 150 an hour, make a bundle off them, then run them off. That's Wall Street. And the little boys never get to see the firm plane. Or the firm limo. You are truly lucky, Mitch. You should thank God every day that we chose to accept you here at good old Bendini, Lambert, and Locke. 90 hours sounds like fun. I could use the rest. It'll pay off. Did you hear what my bonus was last year? No. 485. Not bad, huh? And that's just the bonus. I got 6,000, Mitch said. Stick with me and you'll be in the big leagues soon enough. Yeah, but first I gotta get my continuing legal education. 10 minutes later, the limo turned into a drive that led to a row of hangars. Memphis Aero, the sign said. A sleek, silver Lear 55 taxied slowly toward the terminal. That's it, Avery said. The briefcases and luggage were loaded quickly onto the plane, and within minutes they were cleared for takeoff.
Mitch fastened his seatbelt and admired the leather and brass cabin. It was lavish and luxurious, and he had expected nothing less. Avery mixed another drink and buckled himself in. An hour and 15 minutes later, the Lear began its descent into Baltimore Washington International Airport. After a taxi to a stop, Avery and Mitch descended to the tarmac and opened the baggage door. Avery pointed to a man in a uniform standing near a gate. "That's your chauffeur. The limo is in front. Just follow him. You're about 40 minutes from the Capitol Hilton." "Another limo?" Mitch asked. "Yeah. They wouldn't do this for you on Wall Street." They shook hands, and Avery climbed back on the plane. The refueling took 30 minutes, and when the Lear took off and turned south, he was asleep again. 3 hours later, it landed in Georgetown, Grand Cayman. It taxied past the terminal to a very small hangar where it would spend the night. A security guard waited on Avery and his luggage and escorted him to the terminal and through customs. The pilot and co-pilot ran through the post-flight ritual. They, too, were escorted through the terminal. After midnight, the lights in the hangar were extinguished and the half-dozen planes sat in the darkness. A side door opened, and three men, one of them, Avery, entered and walked quickly to the Lear 55. Avery opened the baggage compartment, and the three hurriedly unloaded 25 heavy cardboard boxes. In the muggy tropical heat, the hangar was like an oven. They sweated profusely but said nothing until all boxes were out of the plane. "There should be 25. Count them," Avery said to a muscle-bound native with a tank top and a pistol on his hip. The other man held a clipboard and watched intently, as if he was a receiving clerk in a warehouse. The native counted quickly, sweat dripping onto the boxes. "Yes, 25. "How much?" asked the man with the clipboard. $6.5 million. "All cash?" "All cash. U.S. dollars. Hundreds and twenties. Let's get it loaded." "Where's it going?" "Quebec Bank. They're waiting for us." They each grabbed a box and walked through the dark to the side door, where a comrade was waiting with an Uzi. The boxes were loaded into a dilapidated van with Cayman produce stenciled badly on the side. The armed natives sat with guns drawn as the receiving clerk drove away from the hangar in the direction of downtown Georgetown. Registration began at 8 outside the Century Room on the mezzanine. Mitch arrived early, signed in, picked up the heavy notebook of materials with his name printed neatly on the cover, and went inside. He took a seat near the center of the large room. Registration was limited to 200, the brochure said. A porter served coffee, and Mitch spread the Washington Post before him. The news was dominated by a dozen stories of the beloved Redskins, who were in the Super Bowl again. The room filled slowly as tax lawyers from around the country gathered to hear the latest developments in tax laws that changed daily. A few minutes before 9, a clean-cut, boyish attorney sat to Mitch's left and said nothing. Mitch glanced at him and returned to the paper. When the room was packed, the moderator welcomed everyone and introduced the first speaker. Congressman something or other from Oregon, chairman of a House Ways and Means Committee. As he took the podium for what was supposed to be a one-hour presentation, the attorney to Mitch's left leaned over and offered his hand. "Hi, Mitch," he whispered. "I'm Grant Harbison, FBI. He handed Mitch a card. The congressman started with a joke that Mitch did not hear. He studied the card, holding it near his chest. There were 5 people seated within 3 feet of him. He didn't know anyone in the room, but it would be embarrassing if anyone knew he was holding an FBI card. After 5 minutes, Mitch shot a blank stare at Harbison. Harbison whispered, "I need to see you for a few minutes." "What if I'm busy?" Mitch asked. The agent slid a plain white envelope from his seminar notebook and handed it to Mitch. He opened it near his chest. It was handwritten. Across the top, in small but imposing letters, the words read simply, Office of the Director, FBI. The note read, Dear Mr. McDear, I would like to speak with you for a few moments during lunch. Please follow the instructions of Agent Harbison. It won't take long. We appreciate your cooperation. Thanks. F. Denton Voiles, Director. Mitch folded the letter in the envelope and slowly placed it in his notebook. We appreciate your cooperation. From the director of the FBI. He realized the importance at this moment of maintaining his composure, of keeping a straight, calm face as if it was simply routine. But he rubbed his temples with both hands and stared at the floor in front of him. He closed his eyes and felt dizzy. The FBI, sitting next to him, waiting on him. The director and hell knows who else. Terrence would be close at hand. Suddenly the room exploded in laughter at the congressman's punchline. Harbison leaned quickly toward Mitch and whispered, Meet me in the men's room around the corner in 10 minutes. The agent left his notebooks on the table and exited among the laughter. Mitch flipped to the first section of the notebook and pretended to study the materials. The congressman was detailing his courageous battle to protect tax shelters for the wealthy, while at the same time easing the burden on the working class. Under his fearless guidance, the subcommittee had refused to report legislation limiting deductions for oil and gas exploration. He was a one-man army on the Hill. Mitch waited 15 minutes, then another 5, then began coughing. He needed water, and with hand over mouth, he slid between the chairs to the back of the room and out the rear door. Harbison was in the men's room washing his hands for the 10th time. Mitch walked to the basin next to him and turned on the cold water. What are you boys up to? Mitch asked. Harbison looked at Mitch in the mirror. I'm just following orders. Director Voiles wants to personally meet you, and I was sent to get you. And what might he want? I wouldn't want to steal his thunder, but I'm sure it's rather important. Mitch cautiously glanced around the restroom. It was empty. And what if I'm too busy to meet with him? Harbison turned off the water and shook his hands into the basin. The meeting is inevitable, Mitch. Let's not play games. When your little seminar breaks for lunch, you'll find a cab, number 8667, outside to the left of the main entrance. It will take you to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, and we'll be there. You must be careful. 2 of them followed you here from Memphis. 2 of whom? The boys from Memphis. Just do as we say, and they'll never know. The moderator thanked the second speaker, a tax professor from New York University, and dismissed them for lunch. Mitch said nothing to the taxi driver. He sped away like a maniac, and they were soon lost in traffic. 15 minutes later, they parked near the memorial. Don't get out yet, the driver said with authority. Mitch did not move. For 10 minutes, he did not move or speak. Finally, a white Ford Escort pulled alongside the cab and honked. It then drove away. The driver stared ahead and said, Okay, go to the wall. They'll find you after about 5 minutes. Mitch stepped to the sidewalk and the cab left. He stuck his hands deep in the pockets of his wool overcoat and walked slowly to the memorial. Bitter wind gusts from the north scattered leaves in all directions. He shivered and flipped the collar of his coat around his ears. A solitary pilgrim sat rigidly in a wheelchair and stared at the wall. He was covered with a heavy quilt. Under his oversized camouflage beret, a pair of aviator's sunglasses covered his eyes. He sat near the end of the wall, near the names of those killed in 1972. Mitch followed the years down the sidewalk until he stopped near the wheelchair. He searched the names, suddenly oblivious to the man. He breathed deeply and was aware of a numbness in his legs and stomach. He looked slowly downward, and then, near the bottom, there it was. Engraved neatly, matter-of-factly, just like all the others, was the name Rusty McDear. A basket of frozen and wilted flowers sat on its side next to the monument, inches under his name. Mitch gently laid them to one side and knelt before the wall. He touched the engraved letters of Rusty's name. Rusty McDear, age 18, forever. 7 weeks in Vietnam when he stepped on a landmine. Death was instantaneous, they said. They always said that, according to Ray. Mitch wiped a small tear and stood staring at the length of the wall. He thought of the 58,000 families who had been told that death was instantaneous, and no one suffered over there. Mitch, they're waiting. He turned and looked at the man in the wheelchair, the only human in sight. The aviator's glasses stared at the wall and did not look up. Mitch glanced around in all directions.
Relax, Mitch. We've got the place sealed off. They're not watching.
And who are you? Mitch asked.
Just one of the gang. You need to trust us, Mitch. The director has important words. Words that could save your life.
Where is he? The man in the wheelchair turned his head and looked down the sidewalk.
Start walking that way. They'll find you.
Mitch stared for a moment longer at his brother's name and walked behind the wheelchair. He walked past the statue of the three soldiers. He walked slowly, waiting, with hands deep in his pockets. 50 yards past the monument, Wayne Terrence stepped from behind a tree and walked beside him. "Keep walking," he said. "Why am I not surprised to see you here?" Mitch said. "Just keep walking. We know of at least 2 goons from Memphis who were flown in ahead of you. They're at the same hotel next door to you. They did not follow you here. I think we lost them."
"What the hell's going on, Terrence?"
"You're about to find out. Keep walking. But relax, no one is watching you. Except for about 20 of our agents."
20?
"Yeah. We've got this place sealed off. We want to make sure those bastards from Memphis don't show up here. I don't expect them."
"Who are they?"
"The director will explain."
"Why is the director involved?"
"You ask a lot of questions, Mitch.
And you don't have enough answers."
Terrence pointed to the right. They left the sidewalk and headed for a heavy concrete bench near a footbridge leading to a small forest. The water on the pond below was frozen white. "Have a seat," Terrence instructed. They sat down. 2 men walked across the footbridge. Mitch immediately recognized the shorter one as Voiles. F. Denton Voiles, director of the FBI under 3 presidents. A tough-talking, heavy-handed crime buster with a reputation for ruthlessness. Mitch stood out of respect when they stopped at the bench. Voiles stuck out a cold hand and stared at Mitch with the same large, round face that was famous around the world. They shook hands and exchanged names. Voiles pointed to the bench. Terrence and the other agent walked to the footbridge and studied the horizon. Mitch glanced across the pond and saw 2 men, undoubtedly agents with their identical black trench coats and close haircuts, standing against a tree 100 yards away. Voiles sat close to Mitch, their legs touching. A brown fedora rested to one side of his large, bald head.
He was at least 70, but the dark green eyes danced with intensity and missed nothing. Both men sat still on the cold bench with their hands stuck deep in their overcoats.